Welcome to PCMC, Pop Culture Man Children. I'm Mike Buongiorno. By the way, if you're in Italy listening to the show, first of all, thank you. Secondly, there's no relation between me and the famous Mike Buongiorno celebrity. I know there are statues of him. I think he's dead now. He was a talk show host, a game show host, just an all-around huge celebrity. I'm not him. I'm not related to him. Just in case you're wondering. It's weird, Nadia, because I'm here with Nadia Cater. Every once in a while someone would be like, oh my god, like that guy. And it's like, I wonder, I've never gone to Italy, but I wonder what it'll be like. Cause it would it be like if I met somebody and like, hey, my name's Jay Leno? I'd be like, get the fuck out of here. No, you're not. Nadia, I digress as I always do. Nadia, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm going to interrogate that. Are you really doing well?
I am fine. I don't know. I guess on a scale, 7, pretty good.
Sure. That's a 7. I'd do a 7 any day. So this is we're at the start of spooky season, and we have a spooky movie for you today. This was your suggestion, Nadia. This is the Japanese film Kwaidan from 1964. Although some places say 65. Sometimes with older movies that could get a little tricky. But Kwaidan, what? Why'd you suggest Kwaidan? It's new to me. This is my first time with it.
Well, I'm really interested in Japanese horror. In general, and you know, the few that we've watched together, like Japanese movies, have been so interesting, and that is a movie that comes up a lot. Is like just like this important film from Japan, and it's also around ghosts, and I thought that was interesting too, because so Kwaidan is an anthology movie with 4 different ghost stories, and they're all really different, and they all have different ghost rules.
Yes.
Which is cool. So and it's just because I had this hype, and I'm like, okay, you know what? I have to see it, especially during the 60s. Kwaidan is very, like, strange. It has that almost Technicolor kind of feel to it.
Yeah.
The colors and stuff. And yeah, that's why I wanted to see it. I'm like, looking at these other, like, clips from different Japanese horror movies, nothing looks like Kwaidan. So I was like, let me give it a shot.
Yeah. This film is made by Masaki Kobayashi. This is his first color film, and he really uses the color. I think the color in this is one of those films where truly every frame a painting. Like, every frame is the most gorgeous composed thing you've ever seen. It's a long film. It's a 3-hour film, but you could tell the story in like 5 minutes. It's interesting. I was even saying to myself, like, oh, I hope we have enough to talk about on the show, because narratively speaking, these are super simple stories, but the film indulges in them. You know, you asked me earlier this week, like, what I thought of it when I first saw it, and I said to you, like, it's a vibe. You know what I mean? It is like. It's you kind of put it on, and it's got this sort of languid quality to it. I mean, I didn't find it boring. I found it entrancing, but it does stretch its narrative out. I mean, we could tell the 4 stories very quickly, but it's the visuals that you have to see here, and the filmmaker wanted complete control, so he found a like an empty warehouse or something.
And it was an abandoned airplane hangar.
An abandoned airplane hangar. Wow!
So imagine how huge that was.
Right, right. Wow. Everything in this movie is constructed. Everything, and I love that. It's one of the reasons why I love animation. I've always been, you know, the sort of bipolar ends of cinema thinking is that cinema's power is in its ability to capture reality, or on the other hand, cinema's power is in its ability to create illusion. And I've always been on the create illusion side. That's why I love animation and I love things like this. I love fakery in a film. Like last year for Christmas, I did an episode on Eyes Wide Shut, which features a very artificial New York, which I love about that movie. This movie, everything in it feels artificial, but it feels like a storybook because it's telling stories of, I guess, feudal Japan. So you're looking back and telling these tales, and these are folk tales. Like some of these I were familiar with from like reading them. So it's so interesting. I've had this gripe for a long time against the Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark movie, because the Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark books are folk tales, and then the movie they made it all into one story, and it's not anthology like it should be. Like this. Qui-Don is the way they should do a Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark movie. It should be an anthology of these folklore stories.
So, just to what you were saying, so you are not in the Bazan camp at all. Like, you don't care about realism here.
No, me and Andre do not see eye to eye. I've never been. I mean, look, there are some films that do it beautifully, and there are some filmmakers. Like I love John Cassavetes and I love his movies that feel like it's just real people freaking out in front of cameras. I do have within me the ability to see or appreciate everything film can do. But in general, to me, it's the illusion that's so magical about it. I mean, like every film is a Frankenstein monster. It's all these disparate parts sewed together, and somehow it means something. And that's just crazy. And so I love to lean into that. There's the backdrops, I guess they're not matte paintings. They're like physically in the background. Like during one of the stories, my favorite story, The Lady in the Snow, there's like eyes. There are eyes painted into the sky. Like there are eyes everywhere watching it. And it's like, what a choice. Like you don't give a fuck about reality. Like sometimes the sky is pink. Sometimes the sky is fucking blue. Like it's whatever the director feels, and I'm for that.
It also, like, the skies are gorgeous, but they also, again, it's like it really is self-contained stories because they're not consistent in that sense of like, 'cause the eyes are only in that part and that's it. And I thought that was really fascinating. Do you ever wonder why anthology movies aren't really a thing? Like, I've wondered if it's because studios feel like the audience needs a central character or a group of characters to relate to.
In a certain sense, like they still there's you and I many Halloweens ago covered a bunch of the original VHS anthology films, and that series has gone on and on and on and on. Those are popular with horror hounds, but I don't know if those films even get theatrical releases. I think they don't do big budget anthologies probably because they feel like having so many starts and stops will be a little bit exhaustive to the audience, which I can understand. That's part of the deal with watching anthology. But no, yeah, they don't want to do it. And but I do wish they would, because anthology is I love anthology. There's on yeah, I'm sorry.
Well, I was just gonna say, it's also what's unusual about it that I just thought of. It's an anthology movie, but it's an anthology with the same director because usually anthology movies will be multiple directors covering different parts. And in that sense, they could seem almost like disjointed because of the styles are so different. But in this movie, even though the characters, the ghost rules, the sets are so different, it doesn't feel disjointed. It feels kind of natural, like you're reading from a book almost, that everything fits together in a weird way.
And there's a sort of sorrowfulness that I feel like does tie through the whole thing. There's something spooky and sad, I think, that every story has in common. There's no jump scares or anything like that. These are sort of, they're folklore, so they're sort of meditative. They're meant to make you think about something, I think.
Interesting.
You know, you and I both watch this on Criterion Channel, and on Criterion Channel, they have an introduction to this film by Grady Hendrix, the author of Paperbacks from Hell and many great fiction books, Final Girl, Support Club, Best Friend's Exorcism. And he makes a point where he says, like, anthology is so good for horror because you're in and you're out. It's just you experience it and you don't have time to really think about it.
That is a really interesting point.
It's sort of like short fiction. Like, I feel like you get away with a lot more in anthology. You know what I mean? Like, you don't pick apart plot holes in anthology stories. You're like, whatever, it's a story. It's here, it's gone, it's a story. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's a good point. I was actually gonna ask you about that in general. Like, would you, some people do consider this movie a horror movie. Would you consider it horror? Or is it just supernatural?
I think it is horror, but I think it doesn't fit our contemporary definition of it. Like, I think if a young horror fan who like loves the Conjuring movies and like loves a lot of the shit they see on Shudder, if they're not familiar with Japanese films or films from this time period, they might be bored by it, and they might be like, okay, that was kind of spooky, because there's nothing in it that's really scary, you know, and there's certainly no jump scares. It's all it's about strange imagery, and it's about just creating a general sense of fear, I think. What
Okay.
do you think? Would you consider it a horror movie?
See that's the yeah, I don't know. I feel like I'm really on the fence on that because I feel like even just I mean, I don't have like a large oeuvre of horror movies, especially from Japan in the 60s, but it feels so out of space and time. And it's weird to even consider that because these folk tales are hundreds and hundreds of years old, but these particular ones are taking a lot from the arrangement and the choices made by an Irish writer who lived in Japan for almost 20 years. Right? So that and that's another strange layer to it because it's like, yes, they're Japanese folk tales, but he's a foreigner coming in and arranging them and making some different choices.
Interesting.
So I don't know if I could even say it. I mean, I feel a little more comfortable in the sense of saying it's stories about the supernatural, and it doesn't necessarily and being about the supernatural does not necessarily mean it's horror, but then it's like it doesn't really fit into anything else.
I think that in Japanese folklore, you do get a lot of tales about ghosts, and they're not all necessarily scary. Ghosts are just ghosts. They're just a part of, the story. Here in particular, you have four stories where the protagonist suffers and doesn't prevail at the end. And I think maybe that's a reason why I might put it more into horror. You look at the protagonist in each story, they all reach a grim fate.
Yeah, they all reach it. That's true too. They all reach a grim fate. And what's similar in, I mean, it's not all horror, but in general horror, there isn't really always morality necessarily, and there really isn't here. It's really just like that people make choices and shit happens to them. That's like, and it's not like, you know, it's not punishment or anything. It's just this is what happened to you.
I do think that there are ideas and maybe even lessons in a way being expressed, but I don't think there's like morals, like do this and don't do that. But I think it, in that sort of folklory way, I think it's sort of like, like be careful what you wish for, or, don't turn your back on someone that you love, or, that kind of thing. Like the lady in the snow. I've been thinking about all week, I've been thinking about what that message could be. Because I've also read that, I've read a version of that story that's not exactly that, but I read a book of Japanese folklore that has a version of that. And then there, I've seen other versions of that same exact plot done in different ways. But let's go in order. Let's talk about these four stories. The four stories in this film, which the film begins with title cards for each film, and even in the middle has like they call it an intermission, but it's like 10 seconds. The four stories are The Black Hair, The Woman of the Snow, Hoichi the Earless, and A Cup of Tea, which is the shortest of them. Hoichi, I think, is the longest of them. Of these four, which was your favorite?
I would say The Woman in the Snow.
Yeah, me
But it,
too.
the thing is like it's kind of weird to even say favorite in a sense because I think that story is the spookiest and also the strangest. But
Yeah.
then also the set of Hoichi and the set of that I thought was really incredible, just
Yeah,
in
yeah.
the sense of like the ghosts in the the castle or whatever that turns out to be a graveyard.
Yeah.
I thought that was amazing, and his the painting on his
Yeah.
body was incredible.
Yeah,
So
yeah.
it's just so hard to say, but I think I did enjoy The Woman in the Snow the best.
Yeah. Yeah.
The colors were gorgeous, and I can't emphasize that enough. And all the snow, and it feels cold, even though you know it's a set and it's fake.
Yeah.
It feels freezing, and I especially really the character design was so weird,
Yeah.
of the ghost.
I think the titular Lady of the Snow, I think she visually at least influences things like the little girl from The Ring who comes out of the well, or the characters from The Grudge.
Oh yeah, the dark hair, the long dark hair.
Yeah.
Yeah, the no eyebrows, the even the ghost skin is very reminiscent of that from
Yeah.
The Ring.
Yeah. Yeah. But the first story is The Black Hair, and it begins in this very beautiful way. We see like this filmmaker, he loves to shoot long shots, and he loves moving his camera and gliding his camera around. It really has, when a camera moves in such a sort of like effortless sort of glidey kind of way, it always feels so much to me like a narrator function. Like, look at this now and look at that now. And we begin by like making our way through this home that's we're told they're impoverished. Of course, me as a millennial, I'm like, yeah, but they still got a house. But
They have
we
more than one room. That's
yeah, I
that
mean,
was
come on,
incredible.
what are you guys bitching about? Yeah, we're sort of like there's we're drawn into the story visually, like we're literally being led by the hand into the story. And this first story I feel is the most romantic in a sort of tragic way of all of them. And it's about a couple. They live in this house, and the man is a samurai, but he doesn't have a good position, or he doesn't have a good like station. And his wife is a seamstress, or we see her constantly with a loom making fabric or whatever. And their house is like charcoal gray and brown and like very, very dark. The colors are amazing and expressive in this. And in the beginning, he leaves her. He's like, I'm leaving you. I can't deal with this poverty anymore. I've got to find a better station in life. And she begs him, like, don't leave, don't leave. And then he leaves. And then we see he finds this other family to marry into. And the color of their house is like beautiful, bright white and like pastels. And his new wife, the second wife, is always wearing like these pinks and purples. And she is like very wealthy, and we see her like buying fabric where his first wife is always making fabric. But what I found romantic is like there's these movies are very contemplative or meditative. There's a lot of people just sitting thinking or walking around thinking. And there's a couple moments where he's married to the new wife, but you see him think about his old wife, and he imagines her in their home. He imagines himself coming home and walking in and seeing her and being reunited with her. And I don't know, it felt very sad to me. Clearly he missed his first wife. He sort of re he doesn't I don't know if he's impotent or what. He doesn't sleep with the second wife. He sleeps in a different room. And eventually he leaves her and goes back to his first wife. And he has this very dramatic monologue or dialogue with her where he's like, I'm so sorry, I love you so much, blah, blah, blah. And they're reunited. And he talks about her beautiful black hair. And she has this long black hair, which visually seems to rhyme with the fabric she's always making. That she's always with this loom, always with the, with this string. And, they embrace and they go to bed together, and he's happy and he thinks he's gotten everything back. He'd rather be poor with the woman he loves than not. And then he wakes up and the house is more destroyed than he even imagined. Where he was sleeping with his wife is literally sunken into the ground. She is a dead body, but her long hair is sort of like wrapped around the room, and then the hair starts attacking him. And
You
then,
know,
yeah, go on,
well, I was gonna say, like, I think the set in that was also really beautiful and haunting, and like it looked almost, if you notice it, like every time it cut from the samurai to the dead boy's body and the rest of the home, things would get more broken down in every cut. So he aged, like his hair changed, and then it starts eventually starts falling out, and his makeup changed, and the lighting changes significantly. It's very stark and gray, and the wife is a corpse. Cuts to him being horrified. Cuts back, she's a skeleton. Then it does it again, and then this time it's just the hair. And I was like, this is so weird. And it's like the house is just like deteriorating. As he's running away from the hare who keeps like coming around him and touching him. And that was the thing that he embraced too, which was interesting. Like, 'cause that's what he was thinking about. He's like, I miss my first wife. I miss her long black hair. And then that's the thing that haunts him.
And this filmmaker has a really interesting visual motif that he does a lot, which he shows people from the back. He shows people turned away from the camera. And when he imagines his wife, he often imagines her from the back, and you see her long, long hair. We should say that the sound in this film is incredible, and the music is incredible. In this last moment where he's rapidly aging and disintegrating, and the hair is like attacking him. We hear, see, all of the sound in this movie is in this weird mid ground between sound effect and music, because it's musical yet it's sound effect, it's diegetic yet it's not. You hear like these weird like cracking sounds, and even at
You
some
know,
point
it's
like.
like breaking wood.
Yeah, it's like, yes, it's like breaking wood, and you get the sense that it's the house disintegrating, but it feels musical, it feels non-diegetic. And at one point he's like trying to get out of the house and he's banging on the door and you don't hear the sound effect of his hands hitting the door. So you're not hearing, the sound is dropped out diegetically, and all you hear is the sort of music of the cracking wood. And there's shit like that all over. Like there's a lot of discordant music. Like just a string being plucked here and there. Really amazing sound and music in this movie. And
Yeah, it's spooky without like. So I think in general, of course I have to compare it to like contemporary horror movies. And usually when something scary is happening, you'll notice like the sounds getting higher and louder and more intense. But in this movie, that doesn't totally happen.
No,
It's
no.
just it, but it still has that similar effect of this is really unsettling.
Yeah.
And it puts you in that same place. And I was
Yeah.
like, this is so interesting.
So, what do you think this story is expressing? Because I found myself asking, because when he goes back home, his wife seems so happy to see him again and accepts him and they're in love again. And I found myself going, was that her genuine emotion? Or is she setting him up to get revenge on him? Is she behind what happens, or is it just the fate of what happened to him? Did she die alone in poverty, and so he's seeing her ghost? Like what's happening here, really?
So what I thought about with this movie was that kind of that phrase, you can never really go home again. That's what I was thinking about throughout this. It's kind of like he had this very specific things that he missed and he needed. But he was still gone for years. That's what the narration says, right?
Yes.
He left her to join this lord. So I guess samurai, like, just from what little I know about Japanese society at the time, is the samurais would work under a lord, and depending on how much money and work that the lord has or influence, is how much money they have.
And he married the
So
lord's daughter.
he married
That's
the
the second
lord's
wife.
daughter as a way to get into fortune, right?
Yeah.
So he has money, but there was an emptiness there. So I think there was a materialism thing going on. And I
Yes.
also think
Okay,
it's
yeah.
so because the comparisons, the houses, the wives, what you get, because the first wife was constantly making things, or at the
Constantly
very least,
working, constantly laboring.
constantly laboring, while the second wife had people do stuff for her. Like the most that she did was really like point at when she wanted something.
Yes.
So I think there's a materialism thing here, but I also think there's a like I said, you can't go home again. Like you made a choice, and you're not gonna, you can't return from that. You have to move forward. But then, yeah, because it is it a revenge thing? Because it doesn't feel like it, but it kind of plays like a revenge thing. Like I don't
Right.
think this right. I don't think there's like a right or wrong answer here, really.
Right, I agree. I guess part of me is thinking like folklore gets in the oral tradition passed down from generation to generation. So it's meant to impart some kind of wisdom to the listener. So you think like if you're telling this story to a younger person, what are you telling them? Be careful what you do. You know, you might make decisions that you can't undo.
I think that's it more than anything.
Okay.
Yeah, because you can't undo it, but also see that's also the confusing thing is because the hair and the situation was so frightening that he literally aged,
Yeah.
right? So that's something else too, or like I also wonder in general about Japanese folklore if there's so much about ghosts. What is it saying about interactions between humans and ghosts? Because from these stories, like I think a common, if we can even say a common occurrence, is that the interaction with the ghost profoundly changes your life and
Yeah.
usually not for the better.
Yeah.
So is it saying something like that? Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's, the
And
effects were just
you could
fun,
fuck
man.
ghosts, right?
And you can
Because
fuck ghosts.
I mean, you don't see a sex scene, but he goes to bed with his wife and wakes up the next day. You assume that they are reconsummating their marriage, you know, and that I think, you know, in American culture, the only time I think American Horror Story season one is the only time I can think of like an American tale where people fuck ghosts. You know what I mean?
I was thinking of Ghostbusters, but that's
Oh
not really
yes, of
horror.
course. Yeah. But that's the interesting thing about these ghosts, right? Because these ghosts in Western media, ghosts I think tend to be ephemeral and non-corporeal. They can float around and go through walls and stuff. They're kind of not really there. You know, like in Casper, where they eat and the food goes right through them onto the ground. Whereas I think in Japan, like they're ghosts, but they're really there. You can really touch them. They can kill you.
Yeah, they could kill you with their force or their will, and that's something that is frightening too because it's so helpless.
Yeah.
And also because they're ghosts, they don't need the things that we need to survive, so they could theoretically haunt you for the rest in for the rest of your
Yeah.
life, right? Yeah, that was, oh man, so spooky. And I do wonder what happens to him. Does he die?
I think he
Like,
does. It ends on a like a freeze frame of the hare. And I know it sounds ridiculous to imagine hare attacking him, but it's done in this very interesting way where it's sort of like you have to imagine how long the hare is. So it's almost like whipping him and tying itself around him. I think and it ends on a freeze frame of him like with the hair around him. I think he does die. I think like maybe you remember like often ghosts are tied to houses, right? We talked about this when we talked about the Japanese horror movie House. And the house I think is a big part of this. So it's sort of like the wife is dead, the house is crumbling, and he's crumbling with it. Like the three of
Yes.
them are in a type of union. I can't figure out though what the hair is about. Like why the hair? Like I know he missed his wife's hair, but how does the hair relate to the production the wife is always doing? Why is it the hair that attacks him?
I
And
honestly,
that
I could
comes
only
up.
guess.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just gonna point out that, like, as I said before, like the long black hair becomes a trope in Japanese horror.
Well, I was wondering if that was a like that was the signifier of beauty
Oh, okay.
because all right, so in this time period, what is a signal of class and beauty are very different than what we think of today. So, like for one thing, they don't have eyebrows. Like the women shave off their eyebrows and paint them higher up.
Yes.
Well, that was seen as beauty. Also, dyeing the teeth black
Yes.
was another thing. And the first wife has her original eyebrows and she has white teeth. So I think
Gross.
maybe, yeah, how disgusting. This woman has her original eyebrows and white teeth, which is
Yeah.
interesting because now a signal of poverty is having bad teeth
Right.
and discolored teeth, right? But or hideousness is teeth, but. Yeah, so what I was think I how I took it was the long black hair was a symbol of beauty and of just this that's all she had literally. She only had beautiful hair because I mean if you look at her she looks poor.
Yeah, right. I just Wikipedia'd teeth blackening. Teeth blackening or teeth lacquering is a custom of dyeing one's teeth black. It was mostly predominantly practiced in Southeastern Asia and Oceanic cultures. It was also practiced in Japan as well as India. Teeth blackening is usually done during puberty. It was seen as a sign of maturity, beauty, and civilization. A common belief is that blackened teeth differentiated humans from animals. Teeth blackening is often done in conjunction with traditions of tooth sharpening and dental avulsion, as well as other body modifications, like tattoos. Teeth blackening and filling were regarded with fascination and disapproval by early European explorers and colonists. I still am interested in, like, what is it meant to look like? Is it meant to symbolize something? Is it meant to look like something? Interesting. Okay. All right, so the next story is it the Lady of the Snow, the Lady in the Snow?
It's called of
The
course
Woman
I
of the Snow.
the Woman of the Snow. Okay.
So we have two guys, an old guy and a young guy, and their job is they, like, I guess they get wood and they sell it in town, and you see them walking through this terrible snowstorm, and it's that super great fake snow. And as I said before, the background, like the eyes, you see eyes in the sky, painted as if they're constantly being watched, but they don't react to it, you know, it's just there. And you hear that great, like, wind sound. And it's this beautiful long, he's really getting a lot out of this airplane hangar. You see these beautiful long shots. At one point, they come to a river. And it looks silver. It looks like it's a river of, like, mercury. It's so beautiful. And it's just, this is such a gorgeous sequence. And the storm gets really bad, and they find a hut to, like, sort of, like, stay in. And then this woman appears, and she's got, like, very pale skin, and she kind of is floating around. She comes up to the old man and, like, sucks his soul out. Is what we're told.
Well, so it kind of like yeah, or like she uses her ice breath to kind of
Okay.
take the life or something like it's kind of vague.
Yeah.
But yeah, so there is yeah, so she sucks the soul out, and she turns to the younger man and she tells him that she feels sorry for him, so she's not gonna kill him like she did the other guy. But
Yeah.
you better not tell anyone about this, or I'm gonna get you.
Yeah.
And then he's like he lives. Yeah, so they're both woodcutters. That was apparently like
Okay.
a medieval job where all you did was like cut wood and sell it.
Sure.
And That where they were staying was kind of interesting because it was a fisherman's hut, and that's actually why they stay in it, because in the dialogue, the younger woodcutter, who's the main character in the story, he says that, oh, the fisherman left his boat on the other side. So I think his idea was they were trying to escape the woods and they couldn't, so he had to stay in that hut that was freezing. And the woman of the snow is like this, she's not really a ghost, it's more like a spirit with powers, you know? Like she's not, I don't think she was ever a person.
Like, does she represent snow? Is she like the element of snow? Especially because, like, she seems to be able to freeze you.
Yeah, I think she's the Japanese version of the Ice King, where she's just such an elemental with powers and just messes with people.
Gunta.
So she makes this like demand, which I feel like is really unfair.
Well,
Never.
that's the heart of it, right?
Yeah. So she makes this demand. He lives out his life. He ends up, just to recap, he goes home and he's so sick and frightened from this ordeal that his elderly mother, like, basically has to nurse him back to health for weeks. And he doesn't leave his hut. And they're, you know, so he finally gets the energy or the courage or whatever you want to call it to go, or the backbone to go back out there. And he meets a woman who's played by the same actor as the snow lady. And they start talking, and she tells him this whole backstory of her parents died, and she's on her way to go to relatives in the city to find a job. But then it ends up he marries her, and they have children, and she's a wonderful wife, and everything's happy go
And there's
lucky.
beautiful scenes of like him and the wife frolicking in like this tall golden like greens, but and the sky is pink. And it's like just such incredible visuals. They have kids. They do it in the grain.
And the villagers, the washwomen who are wa doing their laundry, they're talking about her, and they're like, you know, she said that woman is very lucky to have that, you know, the old woman is very lucky to have her as a daughter-in-law. Everyone is jealous of how amazing and beautiful she
He never
is.
seems to age, they say.
Yeah, you know what I noticed, but I didn't click until now, is like, the storm were all the blue eyes and green eyes in the sky. But then when he's frolicking with the wife, there's one pink closed eye. So it's like an eyelid. And it's like, okay. And then later the eyes come back.
So are the eyes the woman?
I don't know. Is that her powers?
I don't know. Are we the eyes? Are we the viewers?
I don't think there's an answer here. I think it was more like a surrealist approach to it. Like, this is weird and we're gonna do it.
So
But
one day
like,
he's at home and he's made his wife and children for New Year's. He's given them a gift of new sandals. And he's looking at his wife and beautiful visual. He's looking at his wife and then the color drops out. The lights go out. Again, this is non-diegetic. The lights go out and then everything turns blue and she looks like the lady of the snow. Well, the woman of the, I don't know why I keep saying lady. I'm thinking lady in the lake. Woman of the snow, and he, for the first time in his stupid life, he realizes he looks exactly like that woman. Then the sort of blue light goes away, and we come back to reality, and she's like, "What's the matter?" And he tells her the story, and then she's like, "You motherfucker, I told you you can never tell anybody," and she leaves, but she's very angry, and.
But she also threatens him. She says, if it wasn't for those children, I would destroy you. And if anything bad, or if you mistreat them in any way, I will come back and kill you. Which is like, okay. So you're basically leaving this guy to be a single parent, and that's his punishment. That he fucked a spirit. Like he.
So I read a version of this in a book of Japanese folklore about I think it was more like there was nothing to do with snow. It was like a guy, I think it was like a guy who like he was being attacked and so he met the woman in a different way, but it's the same idea. And then this story is also reconfigured into one of the stories in the Tales from the Dark Side movie, which was a great anthology horror movie that we should do in the show at some point. It's based on the Canadian TV show Tales from the Dark Side, but I believe this is an American movie. It certainly has American stars. Tales from the Dark Side. I want to find the year that it was. Tales from the Dark Side, the movie, 1990. Do these have titles? And so in this movie, so the tour story in this movie is it's in New York City, and he meets like a gargoyle monster, and the same thing happens, and then he falls in love with a beautiful woman who is the beautiful woman? It's
But
someone.
also
Oh,
his
it's
life.
Ray Dawn Chong, and they have kids and the whole thing, and then the same thing happens. He tells her, and then she turns back into the gargoyle lady. And then there's this visual that I always remember, which is you see the two little kids crying, and they're like little gargoyle kids. And in that one, she's not mad, but she's sad. She's like, "I told you not to tell," and so you get this weird feeling like she had to be part of it too. Again, there seems to be something very specific here, but I don't know what the lesson is.
I don't know if there really is a lesson. I think it's more about, like, in general, the kind of, well, I mean, not so much the Tales from the Dark Side one, but I think in the Japanese one, it's very much about nature's cruelty, and you don't really have control over that.
But in this story, I feel like she's like setting him up. I don't know.
Well, I think she gives him an impossible ask.
Maybe
That's what
that,
I
yeah, maybe
it
it's about a human being's inability to keep a secret.
I mean, it could be. I think what's interesting, though, is like in the Japanese one, he just loses his ideal wife and the perfect wife because he could not stick to a deal. In the Dark Side one, he become he's an artist that's broke, but then gets that good fortune from his interaction with the gargoyle and also being
Oh,
married
yeah.
to it, right? And then, of course, the children change into gargoyles, so he loses everything.
Yeah.
Whereas in the Japanese one, he doesn't. And I feel like in the American one, it makes more sense in that this is how much you lost. Whereas here, it's more like this is your interaction, and by sheer good luck, twice you survived a horrible force of nature.
Interesting.
So I think the director really went out of his way to make sure that there really isn't any lessons here.
Well, I don't know. Maybe I'm not making myself clear. I don't think that it's moralizing. I don't think it's like, and here's our lesson. I think I'm just thinking more about the function of folklore. So it may not be a lesson, but it might be just some little nugget, some little meme, some little thought that gets passed around. Because I think if we don't get, we get a lot from stories, and if we don't get something from a story, we don't repeat it. So when stories get repeated over and over and over again, there must be something we're getting from it. And I'm just there's something, and this story in particular is so specific. It's such a specific thing. In some ways, it reminds me of the girl with the ribbon on her neck. Do you know that story, the kid story?
Yeah, but what's the lesson? I mean, what's the kind of lesson there other than when a.
He says, "Don't ever take the ribbon off," and then he fucking does it, and her head falls off.
But she lets him do it. She was like, I think, like, well, it depends on the version, but one of the versions I've read was like she was old and sick and dying, and then she told him that
Yeah.
you could take the ribbon off and her head comes off. But like, I guess in. Yeah, I don't know. I still feel like it has to do with nature because
Nature. Okay.
of this the set of the Snow Woman, the eyes and how they
Yeah.
open when she's in full form, the
Yeah.
snow. It could really be about like more like I guess I can't help but keep coming back to that idea is that nature is
Yeah.
so unforgiving and you're lucky. It's not that you're better. It's that you're lucky that it didn't kill you. Like it killed. And also, if you consider the woodcutters, like one was young and one was old. So maybe the old guy died because he was in a harsh environment, and the younger
Okay.
guy survived because he was younger. Like there wasn't really There's nothing about them except we don't know anything about these two characters
Right.
except those two things. One's young and one's old.
Right. Right.
She also, like you said, she floats. It's kind of like she almost it's almost like a wind kind of thing. It's very uncanny the way she moves. And the costume itself, it's like she's wearing this kind of white kind of I guess a kimono, I'm not sure. But like the way the sleeves are so long and wide that you just see her like hands come out, and it kind of makes her arms look shorter than they should be. Like that in itself is uncanny because she looks humanoid, but also very clearly not human. It's almost comical in a way if it wasn't kind of creepy.
Let me ask you what a similar question to what I asked you with the last story, which is the lady, oh my God, I'm sorry, the woman, what is, forget about the American one because it is different. In this story, in this film, is it a setup? Does she really love him when they're together? Is she always waiting for him to fuck up so she can leave?
I think it's a setup because I think it's also like if you think about what people have said. So like his mother also talked about how great she is and how she's an incredible daughter-in-law and mother to their children, as well as the washwoman too. So separately, people are like, "You're amazing." And I feel like she's like the ideal wife because she wanted to take that away from him. She wanted to give him something and take it away and make him feel bad about it.
But if
And
he
I
never told, she would have stayed the whole time.
Well, maybe she knew that he would tell.
She knew that he would.
Because it's such a terrifying event
I feel like
and
if I were. I don't have kids, but I feel like if I had a son and my son was like, oh, I have a big secret and I was thinking about telling my friends, I'd be like, son, sit down. Let me tell you the story of the woman of the snow. And then at the end, I'd be like, and the point is, nobody can keep a fucking secret.
I think she's a jerk. I have all the ghosts in this movie. I think she's the biggest jerk.
The ghosts of the next story, I think, are not very much jerks, although they're warriors. So now we this there, there's a title. We see a river, or water, running water, and then we see a title on the screen that says intermission. And I thought it was going to be like a minute, but it's not. It's like 10 seconds, and I was like, did they cut something out? Is it just like you can't even go and pee in that time? So I was really surprised by that. But there is an intermission, and then we get to what's the longest story in this movie, Hoachi the Earless, Huichi the Earless,
Yeah, it's like Huichi,
Huichi.
the earless. I think that's the closest we're gonna get tonight. They're not native Japanese speakers. I don't know. I would say that the ghosts in this one. I mean, it really depends, though. So actually, let's get into the concept here. What's the story frame, Mike?
Well, this one is interesting because it begins with a long prologue. We learn about this battle, and we see this big painting or tapestry, whatever it is, of a battle. And then the camera will zoom into the tapestry, and then we'll transition to live action images, as if like we are seeing a tapestry come to life. And we see all of these boats at sea, and they're not like big boats. They're like tiny little boats that like two people could be on. And there's all these vibrant colors. And it's these people. I guess they're different. I didn't, I wasn't, I got a little lost here. I guess they're different sects or whatever. They're different groups fighting for each other. And there's a baby there that they call the Infant Emperor. And he has like these carers that are with him, and I basically like it's a super super bloody battle. Everyone dies, and then the woman holding the baby emperor jumps in the water and kills herself, and everyone follows her. So basically, it's like this is historic. And by the way, if this is real history, I apologize for fucking this up so much. It's basically, it's beginning with this historical tale of like this great, huge battle where many, many, many lives were lost. And then they say the sea was haunted for 700 years. and Heike crabs that have human faces on their shells, it looks like human faces on their shells, are haunted because of these people. And but so then we get to the, and this goes on a while, but then we get to the next part of the story, which is Huichi. And Huichi is blind, and he lives and works in a
A monastery.
yeah, monastery, yeah. Right, there are monks around, and he's sort of like a servant there. That's his life. He plays this stringed instrument. I forget what it's called. They refer to it a couple times. It's, do I have it written down?
Biwa. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. Biwa, which is a plucked string instrument, kind of like a lute.
Yes. And he plays that beautifully. And one day he's playing it, and a ghost of like a soldier comes up to him and says, like, come with me. I want you to play at this reception for these important people. And he does. And everyone at the monastery sort of sees, like, well, he looks very pale. He looks like he's tired. Like, he's been going out every night in the middle of the night. We don't know what he's doing. And the head monk or the head priest is played by Takashi Shimura, who was Dr. What's his name? He's protagonist of the original Godzilla. It goes on for a while. Like, there's a repetitiveness of these stories. And he keeps going out. There's some interesting moments of impressionism where, like, we'll see a close-up of Huichi's face as he's trying to figure out what the noise around him is. But since he can't see it, we can't see it. It's interesting sort of subjectivity. Let's see. The ghost comes back for him and tells him to come with him. And the ghost tells him you can't tell anybody where you go. You see it taking a physical effect on Huichi. One night, he goes out, and we see where he goes, and it's like this, it's a graveyard, right? It's like a cemetery, but what he perceives, or perhaps what we see, is like all of these different soldiers of di and then there di it's all the different sides of that battle. It's basically everybody from that battle on every side, and the song he's playing on his instrument is telling the tale of that battle. So they're like, tell us the tale of it. So he sings it for them. And then there's some really beautiful imagery, and there's some interesting things, like when he talks about them, because I think he sings with it too. When he sings about them dying, you then see the ghosts are all like splayed out on the stage, like looking dead. And it's just really interesting stuff. And two of the monks or priests or whatever, they're like, they follow him because they're like, we want to see where he goes. And the flame from their torches comes off their torches and starts like floating around on its own.
It's kind of like a will-o-wisp, like you're
Yes,
seeing
yeah.
that glowing. Yeah. So they see that, they're frightened, they're freaking out, and Huichi's like, "What are you doing? I'm performing for the court." And like, this
Right.
tale is so long, it takes multiple days for him to go through
Yeah,
it.
yeah.
And that's when, they bring him back to the main priest, and the priest tells him, like, there's nothing there. You're not in a court, you're in a graveyard. And I feel like that was like I
Yeah,
think
yeah.
in a weird way, it was kind of similar to, like, do you remember The Haunting of Hill House, where the father is in the car and he's arguing with his son about like their childhood, and then he's
Yeah.
like, "You keep writing about a tree house. There was never any tree house." And it's all like, "Woo,
Yeah.
it was never there."
Right.
And I loved that. I was like, "Ooh, it's spooky." And
Yeah.
they also make a note that ghosts will control you and kill you, or they'll take your spirit or take your body. And that's what they're doing, is
You
they're taking
can't,
your body.
right, you can't, almost like fairies, like you can't answer their requests, because then they'll drain you, and that's what they're doing to him. They're sort of draining him. So they're like, okay, here's what we're gonna do. We are going to paint all over your body the Heart Sutra from Buddhism. So his whole body is covered in Japanese characters. And they're like, this will make you invisible to the ghost. And when the ghost comes, you have to like you can't answer them, you can't move, you can't do anything. You have to be completely still and don't freak out, and then eventually the ghost will leave you alone and then you'll be okay again. It's him, Hoichi, with the stuff painted all over his body. I think he's a really evocative image. It's the thumbnail on Criterion. It reminds me a little bit of Hellraiser, the Pinhead from Hellraiser. It's just a really interesting visual. And then what happens?
Well, they, of course, like I feel like Hoichi gets like the shit end of the stick in this story, where he's blind, so he doesn't know what they're doing. The monks paint his entire body, except they forget his ears. That's why it's called Hoichi the Earless, even though we're introduced to this character as he's blind. And what happens is when he's standing completely still and ignoring the soldier that comes back to call him, is that the soldier sees his ears floating there. Not doesn't question it at all. It's like, oh, well, he's gone, and you just leave these ears. Well, I better bring this back so they at least know I did my job. And he pulls on Hoichi's ears, and Hoichi keeps like knocking into walls, and then eventually he like rips them off. It was very strange because the noises too, again, was like, is this diegetic or not? Where like he's slamming against the walls every time the ghost pulls his ears, and it's just like a big noise, like boom, boom, like that. And you're like, oh, this is weird. And like you don't actually see the ears tear off, I don't think.
No, but they do, and then he's free of the ghost. But then it goes on where now noble people do come and to listen to Hoichi play, and we find out that he beco and they bring treasures, and we find out that he becomes wildly successful as a musician. So I found myself thinking, like, again, you'll argue with me, if there's a lesson here, is it that artists give everything for their art? Because I mean, it's certainly even if that's not it, it's certainly fascinating, right? That we have a character that's blind, and then that blind character loses his ears. He doesn't become deaf, by the way. He just physically loses his ears, but it's fascinating nonetheless.
It is, and it doesn't affect his playing at all,
No. And
but
it seems to be a good luck charm. Like, after his ears are taken off, his life seems to take an upturn fortune, which is something I think you see a lot in these folk tales. Like after the like in the Woman in the Snow, after she says keep the secret, he meets that girl and he starts being successful. It's like, if your life turns towards fortune, it could be a problem, or there could be some dark hand of fate that's making it happen.
yeah, and you wonder, is it like, was it being in contact with the ghost? Was it like people hearing about the story? Or was it more like the iconography of like an earless blind monk is plays these tales of battle? Like is he a novelty? It's also, if he's a monk, wouldn't he like not be allowed to take these kind of gifts?
I
Wouldn't
don't
it be
think
more of a
he
gift to
is.
him?
I think he just works there.
It's, well, so here's my amalgam of medieval understanding, which could be wrong, but because he is disabled, they don't, I think in general, if he can't work, they'll send, like, if there's something, and I've heard this in different, like different countries and stuff, it's like if you're disabled in some way, you can't, your family can't take care of you, so they send you off to be taken care of, usually by religious figures. So I mean, they never say any of this in this movie, but that's my assumption, is like, 'cause he's blind, he can't work, and if he can't work, he can't contribute to the family, and he can't take care of his own family, so give him to religious people. So maybe he's not a monk, but he's part of the temple, and being part of the
He
temple
is.
staff, yeah. So, yeah, so like being part of the temple staff means that you you're, I think you're still locked into some of those rules. So I don't know if they're really, I don't know about the lesson either, because it's, we know that he's fortunate because the story tells us, but we don't know how he feels about it.
Right, that's true.
Like, we don't know if he's, if he accepts his fate, if he is upset, if he's happy. We have no clue. He just plays,
Yeah.
and that's all he does.
I said before that all of the protagonists come to grim fates, but he kind of doesn't. Other than losing his ears, which is a painful ordeal, he's probably the only character that his interaction with ghosts betters his life, at least in one way.
Yes, except the painful ordeal, which is
Right.
like they were ripped off. So that
Yeah.
is like, imagine the force of that versus being cut with something sharp. Like,
Right.
that is something too that's cruel. But yeah, but it's also like he's, I mean, we could still debate if he's better off or not, because he still lives at the temple and he still serves the temple.
Right.
Like, it, I mean, yeah, he gets these great gifts and food and stuff, but I mean, are the, is that better? I can't tell.
Well, I thought he was better off because his life can be, he doesn't have to fetch pails of water anymore. His life can be music. He can
That's a good
be
point.
just a music. He can just do concerts for people, which is what he obviously enjoyed.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair.
Yeah.
Sorry.
So.
I was just gonna say, you're kind of just left wondering about
Yeah,
that.
of course. Yeah. The last story is the shortest and it has no ending. It's also the only story that has a sort of a wraparound. It has different levels to it because we see a writer writing a book and then we see what he's writing and that's our story. So it's got a framing device.
So it's kind of
And
like a story within a story, you would
yeah,
say.
yeah. And in the framing device, the author who's narrating, and a lot of the most of these have some kind of narration, like actual voiceover narration. And the writer narrating is saying something like, he tells us that there are tales that have no ending. And I guess there are folk tales that have no ending. And he starts to write the story of a guy who is a guard at a lord's manor, and he goes to drink tea from like this big pail of tea or whatever, and he sees a reflection, a face reflection in the tea, and he throws it out, and then he does it again, and he sees the face again, and basically, and this the name of the story is A Cup of Tea, and we hear when this is happening, we hear like a buzzing sound that sounds a little bit like a fly, but again, it could be music. The he's then visited one night by the ghost that he saw reflected, right? And he tries to attack it, or he does attack it, and he attack him, and he gets stabbed and hurt, but then he disappears. And then the next night, three ghosts appear to him, one in blue, one in orange, one in green. And they come to say that the first ghost was hurt by him, and he will return next month. And then it's like this long fight scene of this guy fighting against these three ghosts, and they're like disappearing and moving, and he can't really get a hold of them. And at one point, he does kill them, but they all get right back up. And the music in this scene is crazy because it's like this, it's like this discordant. Like at one point, I was like, is the speaker in my TV breaking? Because the sound keeps going in and out. And then it's like, oh no, I rewound it. I was like, oh no, it's the music here. It's this wild, discordant music, which I guess goes along with the idea of a story that doesn't have an ending. And then that's it. It's just over. And then we go back to the framing story, and we see for some the writer's not there for some reason, but a publisher comes in to read his story, and then the publisher goes to drink, right? And or the wife. The wife of the writer goes to drink, and then we don't see what she sees, but she freaks out. And then the publisher goes and he looks in the pail of tea and he sees the writer, and the writer's like all like white, old, ghostly. And
Yeah, and
that's
like reaching out for him.
yeah. And then it
Yeah.
just the last image is like a cup on the ground, and that's it. It's like it's this tiny little thing, this story. It's really the most odd. Because it does, I mean, it doesn't end.
No, it's more about like just that strange imagery. It's okay, you know what? I had a thought. What if the commonality between all the stories is storytelling itself? Right? Like it's really more about different stories and how they engage the viewer. So like the first one was clearly about like haunting and romance. The second one was about, I guess, supernatural entities. The third one was again about like, because Hoichi is a storyteller. That's what he, so like that's like his playing is like he's playing, but he's also playing to accompany this, but like this ancient war story. And then this one is literally a writer. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, this is a more modern time period versus the other ones because there's technology and there's writing. So he's, it's
Right, the
about,
story he's writing it would be is older. The story of the guy with the T, yeah.
So I think it's more about just kind of storytelling and what happens in that. It's just very,
Interesting.
it's
Interesting.
so, I mean, it doesn't really go anywhere, but it's like it feels, it is a weird addition to the rest of them. Like it, and I feel like the filmmaker does this on purpose. Like it he's try, I think he's trying to like, because he knows people, maybe not people directly like us, but people are going to try to analyze it and dissect it and find the commonality, because that's what human beings naturally do. We do that in our brains all the time. We try to make sense of things and we make connections. But like here, I feel like this whole movie is it like you can't really make connections here. And I'm going to deal with that.
But there are thematic connections, like you just said. I think I agree with what you're saying about the storytelling aspect, because the tapestry is also itself like a storytelling device. And in The Lady in the Water, he tells a story. The Lady in the Water. Boy, my
That
brain's not
really
working.
stuck with you, yeah.
Yeah, that horrible M. Night Shyamalan movie. The woman in the Woman of the Snow, he tells her a story, right? And in the first one, is there any story? There's no story really in the first one.
Well, I
Yeah, I
think
do
this.
think it's a yeah, but I still yeah, I agree with you though. I think there's a theme there. It's just fascinating because if you think about like if these were the four he was going to go with, he could have put them in any order, but he chose to put the one that has no ending at the end. And the
Yeah.
writer becomes like a ghost. So is he saying like I'm a ghost?
Well,
Filmmaker's a ghost?
I mean, it also kind of feels like, in a weird way, like almost like a campfire storytelling where of like, you're telling a ghost story and then like something scares you in real life. That's kind of what it felt like in a way. Like,
Like you
but
like you're right,
now.
you're like, and then he was fighting the three ghosts. And then this happened, and you like grab some kid, and they're like, ah!
Yeah, and then he gets him. And like this one is like, but now you become the ghost. So it's like the writer is writing about this interaction between ghosts, but then he becomes a ghost in the middle of it.
And I mean, what are ghosts, right? They're memories. They're something that was alive before, and now this is what's left of them. That's sort of what a story is, if you think of stories as being like memory, right? It's the residue of something that once was.
Yeah, he was a writer and now he's a ghost himself. There's it's so strange. It was just such a weird choice.
Yeah, but I think very effective, especially at that point in the movie, because it is a long movie, and that last story, you don't expect it to go where it goes and then have like a long fight scene, really. But also like one of the most ineffectual fight scenes, because he's like never he even when he does land a blow on them, it doesn't do anything to them.
Yeah,
It's
it's very
like
futile.
useless.
Yeah, I just thought like the colors of the fighters were interesting. It really reminded me of like almost like Mortal Kombat or something. Or like Power Rangers, like the simple motif of like they're all basically the same except they're different colors. You know? That's how you tell them apart. That's it. Because when I was first watching it, I actually thought they were the same person at first. And then I was like looking, I'm like, no, they're not the same person split up. They're three different people, but
When
they all act the same.
the first ghost comes, the ghost that he saw reflected, does I don't remember, does the ghost tell him who he is? Do we ever learn who the ghost in the reflection of the tea is? Or is that unknown as well?
I don't know. I don't think so. I feel like in that sense, it was like, I don't know. If we look at it that way, it's kind of like meaningless in itself. It's just like you're gonna be messed with.
You will be haunted by something.
It'd be like, 'cause because you exist in this time period, you're gonna be haunted. Like that's Oh man.
It's interesting. And the older you get, you'll be haunted. And part of the aging process is at some point something will haunt you.
Okay. So, huh.
Yes.
Yeah, no, actually, I was trying to like read if there's like look up really quick, is there any analysis in a cup of tea? And it's like not really. It's just the stuff we've been talking about. It's really more like this is metatextual. And like, okay, what does that mean? Like, it's just a commentary about looking up folklore. I'm wondering if he's haunted because he was doing that research. Like, is that the thing? Is he paying the price?
I see what you mean.
Yeah, because the writer was researching folktale, like that's part of it, to write the story. And then he's in a tea barrel or water barrel for some reason. Like, does that mean it's like you're being again, it's like I'm actually doing what I told said I wouldn't do or I didn't want to, but it's like, is he being punished in a way for diving deep into these kind of haunted fairy tales, folk tales, and becomes haunted himself? I don't know.
What if at
Or
the
a
very
haunting.
end we see him in the tea and then it just fades out and you see Snapple, and it was all a lot, it was all a 3-hour commercial for Snapple. Snapple made of ghosts, the best stuff on earth.
Oh my goodness. So what do you think about it overall?
Overall, I, pun intended, I find it haunting and beautiful. I think what the Japanese get that we might not is that there's something interesting about ghosts. Like, they're not just scary. We're drawn to them. Like, you should be looking for ghosts, maybe. There's something very beautiful about this movie. You could just sort of put it on and just sort of like go with it. It's all just tones and feelings, and it tells its story at its own pace.
It's also kind of like it's a weird intersection between like it's an anthology movie, but it also feels very experimental in some ways. So and which is like this is not how you would usually experience experimental movie, so or film. So I think that was something I really enjoyed is really grappling with that and the stuff I've talked about a little earlier, which is just like it's a movie that challenges you to come up with solutions, but it doesn't give you anything. It doesn't give you anything to really it doesn't give you any answers. It just exists and you have to put yourself in a place where like you can accept that there's no an you have to accept that what you come up with is probably not what was actually the intention was. But there's also something like, and because it challenges you in that way, you think about it more
But also, a
rather than.
technicality might not mean anything, right? Because what happens to the author? He's stuck in the tea. Like, it maybe it's about how you read it. Maybe after all, it's just like a post-structuralist thing. Like, it's like, how do you read this? Because we keep reading it, right? They get passed down. We continue to read these tales.
Yeah, exactly. How we read these tales. And I think it's so strange. Like as like if you look at the horror movies, just a few from the 60s like Koroneko or Onibaba, they're very strange. They're so different from
I haven't
this.
seen those.
I saw Onibaba. I've read about Koroneko. And Onibaba is really dark. It's more set in realism, even though it gets to a point of very supernatural. But the concept is this woman and her daughter-in-law, her son died in war, and they're impoverished, and there's a famine going on. So what they're doing is they hunt samurai, like wandering soldiers, and kills them and takes their stuff. So it's very fuck, and then they throw their bodies in like the swamp and they sell their shit so they can survive. It's very dark. Like but it's also grounded in that kind of desperation and fear, where this isn't. at all. And it's so colorful and bright and just like it is it's you let it wash over you like paintings in a sense. And it's just in those comparisons, I've never seen a movie like this either. I've seen we mentioned you mentioned that story from the Tales from the Dark Side that took from this. I would argue some scenes in Paul Schrader's Mishima, the artificial
The stories in the
sections
stories.
feel very similar to this.
Yeah, I agree. I agree.
Especially the colors and how fake the sets look. Like you're not the sets aren't supposed to look real. They're just supposed to evoke this feeling. And I just really enjoyed that for the challenge, like the intellectual challenge of watching this movie.
But I also think that like you and I are taking this intellectual exercise, but I don't think that you need to. Like you can just put it on and vibe with it, and I think just get a lot out of what's happening without ever having to. It's not like like a Christopher Nolan movie where like you kind of have to chew on it after to get the flavor out. Like this is flavorful. This is beautiful even on its own, just watching it.
He was never allowed this level of control again. Like
Yes.
all this, the how much money and time he sunk into this product, they he throughout the rest of his career, no studio would let him do that again. And I don't think we see this level of control again. Because also, you mentioned earlier, you talked about the lighting, and that was something that Grady Hendrix talked about in his introduction to this movie of like that the way the production was is that. It takes so many hours and so many people to change everything for the story for very short scenes, like how the lighting changes, how the set changes, and it's fucking bananas. Like it's bananas that this was made, and I don't think we're ever gonna see something like this again. Not practically, at least. We'd probably see a lot of
No, not
CGI
no,
bullshit,
practically no.
but incredible.
Have you seen any other films by this director?
No, I haven't.
Me neither, and I'm a little embarrassed, although not, to say that this director seems like an important person that I don't really know anything about. I'm not embarrassed because in fact I always say like the saddest thing is if I've seen every film and know everything. I love that there's always more to discover. But I'm not familiar with this director at all. And supposedly, this is unique amongst his films because a lot of his films are contemporary and very political.
Right. Or they're like, what do you call it? Like period pieces. And this is very, I
Yeah,
mean, the
period, yeah.
setting is in the past, but it's not a period piece at all. So this is like
Oh,
a
I see what you mean.
weird, yeah. So I mean it's
It
grounded
doesn't.
reality. Yeah. So it's interesting to see this is what he came up with given that level of control and style and budget. I'm curious about how his other movies would play off.
I want to see more of his films.
Yeah.
I do think that this movie is a good movie for spooky season. I think. You're thinking about ghosts and stuff. I do think it's a good watch for fall.
I agree. I'm glad that we watched it for the fall. I think it really sets the mood, or is a part of the mood, the continuing mood.
I love that scene where Hoichi gets a pumpkin spice latte and just drinks it, and he's just like he loves it, He's like, I might be blind, but I'm not blind to these delicious pumpkin spices.
I'm amazed that you went that route and not like when we saw the soldier in a cup of pumpkin spice latte.
Oh
But
yeah.
that was good. That was good. I like that.
Nadia, thank you so much for being here. You are always a delight. Thank you for suggesting this film. This was a lot of fun. I enjoyed watching this week. I'll be honest with you, and this is something I don't always do. I did not watch it in one sitting. I didn't mean to, but just the way that life worked out this week, I had a lot going on. So I ended up watching each story on its own. So I have not experienced it all as one thing, which of course I typically would want to do before recording an episode. But I have to say, watching each story on its own, I found it delightful. It felt like a TV show. Like I was like, oh, what's this story? I kind of really liked doing it that way, actually.
Okay, that's interesting. Usually I watch movies all the way through unless I have a crazy week and I'll
I
split it
mean, me
up.
too.
Yeah. But like for this movie in particular, I watched them in two separate pieces. So I
Okay.
watched the first two, and like exactly how you said, like almost like watching television, like watching two episodes in a row and then being like, okay, I'm gonna save this and
So you
watch two
took the
episodes.
intermission, the intermission that they spoke of, you took it. You were like, I will take a 24-hour intermission and come back.
Exactly. I was like, yeah, you're thank you for giving me this prolonged life break. But
Yes. Yeah.
I still think it works so well like that because they're so self-contained.
Yeah.
It really does. You could just watch one of them and be like, this is good for the night, and then come back later.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being here. It's always a pleasure to have you. Naducator, everybody, give them a hand. Thank you so much. We end every episode by saying,
Go bye-bye.